Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2018. Lecture 2, delivered on January 22, 2018. The title of this lecture is The Federal Reserve.
Tonight's special topics, the Federal Reserve. Before I get into that, there was one last thing I wanted to go over with you about finance. Tell you about finance as a major, or as a minor, possibly. Do I have any finance majors in here? A scattering. I'll try to bring a few more of you over to the dark side so that you can enjoy finance. I caution you, finance, one side of finance, and I will deal with this in the ethics lecture on Wednesday. Tonight I cover the Federal Reserve, which isn't in the book. And Wednesday night, I cover ethics, which is also not in the book. Now, the ethics lecture, I'm told I'm supposed to teach you ethics. The state does. The state of Illinois wants me to teach you ethics. But what they want me to do is to teach you, this is the law, you shall obey the law. And that basically, you know, I'm diplomatic, you can KMA. I'm going to tell you ethics on the real level, the challenge of it. Finance is the most corrupt of all the business fields. Now, that's not my opinion. Forbes magazine said that. And when you have Forbes magazine saying finance is the most corrupt of the business careers, well, that's scary. But I am trying to create a new legion that's going to overcome what's been going on in this field since long before I was even in it. But I want to tell you about the different careers in finance very briefly, just to give you an idea of the scope of what can happen in this field. First of all, when people talk, I'm going to major in finance, a lot of them are thinking of investments, which is only one type of finance career. And it's also one type that is rapidly shrinking. And it's very difficult to get in. Investments is buying and selling stocks and bonds and other securities, that kind of stuff. Broker, investment banker, that kind of. And the reality of it is that there are tens of thousands of people whose careers were in investments who are unemployed or they found something else to do with their lives. Because first of all, investments is the connections you have to have to get to Wall Street. You're probably going to need to be at an Ivy League school. It's not going to hurt if some relative of yours is already connected on Wall Street. Otherwise, you're going to end up working in some penny stock house or some boutique, or worse yet, you'll be in a boiler room, and I'll talk about that later. And also, the field is just going to be eaten alive by artificial intelligence. It already is by the pseudo-artificial intelligence financial engineering programs, software. It's very rapidly shrinking. Don't tell me, well, I do day trading, so I'm ready. No, you're not. That day trading stuff, don't even come to me with your day trading. That's like saying I play with Tonka trucks and you want to fly a fighter jet. Okay, investments. Here's one that is very prospective right now. We have an actual institute for financial planning. It's well-ranked. This is where you help people, families, households, put their money away so that they can achieve goals later. Financial planning, if you want to help the poor and the working class and the middle class, financial planning isn't where you need to be. Financial planning, you're working with people who have money, and you want to help them with that money. Now, you're going to have to probably be a sales type. You're going to have to convince them to trust you with money of theirs. And most likely, if they are well-to-do, They've already got a financial planning set up with a bank or with a financial planning company, and you're going to have to convince them to try you out, to give you a chance with a little bit of their money before they'll trust you even further. One of my former students from some years back, I had him talk to my business club. He talked about his first summer. He just, full business suit, walking the neighborhoods of the wealthy and the upper middle class here in this area, sweating day after day. Here's my card. If you'd like to have me help you with financial planning, just give me a call. And then he'd back away. He did that over and over. It was hard for him. He nearly lost his wife, his family, and finally it began to bite. People started calling. You know, I've got this inheritance, $50,000. You know, would you give us a plan for what you'd do with it? He is now making more money than he'll even tell me. I'm pretty sure he's making well in excess of $1 million a year. It's just a lot of work. There is the back room where you do the analytics, but that is a very small, narrow field, especially within the age of the AIs. So most likely you've got to have a willingness to go out there and sell, to provide them with services honestly and ethically and all of that, because they're going to be very interested in having you not screw up. And it's going to be scary sometimes when the market goes down hard, and it will again, really hard. You're going to have to do a really good tap dance to explain why your clients lost a whole bunch of money. And that's part of how you handle it, is you know how to keep that from happening as badly as it could for them. Financial planning is very prospective, a lot of careers. This one is an 800-pound gorilla in finance, insurance. Now, I'm not really talking too much about personal insurance, selling insurance to mom and dad for their car. I'm talking about commercial insurance. We have one of the three top schools in the nation, the Katie School of Insurance. The director is a great friend of mine. I take students up there and introduce them to him if they look like they're really serious about it. 500,000. That's how many jobs are going to need to be filled in the next 5 to 7 years in insurance, because insurance hired a lot of people in the 60s and 70s, and then they rode those people, and now they're retiring. And the insurance industry is throwing money at programs that will bring students into insurance. Everything from commercial brokering, underwriting, account management, on through to risk management. It is a hot, hot field. And you'll see very quickly, if you major in insurance, how interested very big companies are, international companies. Another one that is out there, this was one of my specialties, in fact, is real estate. I'm not talking about wearing a gold jacket and selling houses in nice neighborhoods and bad neighborhoods. I'm talking about commercial insurance, where you are doing the financial analysis. Do we buy this apartment complex? Do we build this strip mall? Or do we tear down an open mall because now people are going back to the closed malls? How do we finance this skyscraper or that giant warehouse? That's real estate, commercial real estate. It's always been there, and it always will be there, because there will always be land. Not just here, but eventually even in space. Real estate will be there if you know how to play it. Okay. Another one, which is where I'm going to take you tonight, is in the lecture on the Federal Reserve, is institutional finance. This is institutional, is a fancy way of saying banks, credit unions, other types of places where surplus economic units are matched with deficit economic units. In other words, things that have money and things that need money oftentimes go through financial intermediation services of institutions like banks. Always jobs there. I mean, I've got lots of students. One of the things is, though, that oftentimes you'll start out like a teller position, but if you're aggressive and you know how to do it right, you can move upward in a bank very quickly. If you are savvy, well-dressed, and know how to play the game, institutional finance, I've got some students just from not too many years ago that are making really good money, a lot better than I am. Okay, institutional finance. Now, I'm going to tell you a couple here. There's a broader one around it. We won't even talk about it here except me. I don't know if anyone else. I take my students places, the club I run, I take them places where they can see this. Here it is. Bet you wouldn't even thought of it. Sports finance. I'm not talking about little streams of money. I'm not even talking about rivers of money. I'm talking about oceans of money. I mean, vast seas of money flowing back and forth across the planet. It is unbelievable the amount of finance that is involved. Okay, we build the stadium, or do we have a couple more years and rehab the stadium we've got? We got a player here. What kind of a contract can we offer? How do we finance the contract? Okay, we got a player here. He's hurt himself after his second season. What are we going to do about it? Because he's got a 5-year contract with us. How do we mitigate the risk of injuries to these players? And we're paying ungodly money, and they're not performing for us. Those kinds of things. I took my students up to the White Sox. I also stadium. They learned the eye-opening world of this. I took them to the Joliet Raceway, where they saw hardcore finance. It's just bottom line. We've got to get butts in those seats to keep going. And that means that we've got to get all of these people who are out there now who are our current fans. That's fine. We've got all those weirdos, drunks, tweakers, and all that. We got to get a whole new generation in those seats. So how do we bring the kids in without scaring the kids out of their minds when the tweakers dance, when the dragsters take off? Okay. And also, on the drag strip side, one of our ISU alum is a drag racer, and he is affiliated with the Joliet Raceway to some extent, and he was explaining his finance. He has got a limited lifetime as a drag racer. He has got to make enough to live the rest of his life after drag racing. Why does he have a limited life? Because every time he takes off from that on that green light, his retinas detach a little more. And he wants to finish before that one time when he sees the green light and then he sees black all the way down to the end of the track. So we've got to provide a setup for him with all the commercial sponsors, plaster all these different advertisers all over him, find a way to put his money in a bank so that he can live his years out, probably disabled, probably very disabled afterwards. This is only a small part of a much larger type of finance, entertainment finance. Words can't even describe the amount of money in this. It's beyond your wildest imagination. I had a fine woman. She wanted me to find her a couple of career-oriented people because she ran a distribution company, the intermediary between the producers of a movie and the movie theaters that would put those movies in the box office. I got no one who was interested. Well, what's there in that? Oh, God. Those distributors have the stranglehold on the movies that get to the box office as opposed to going straight to DVD or Netflix or something like that. Okay, that is entertainment, and it's all music, just comedy, just shows of all kinds, TV, radio, internet. It's all finance behind it. We don't even talk about it with you here, which is unfortunate. I'd like to run a course or two in this, but they don't see it yet. Anyway, so there you go. There's some of your prospects. It's the world, and it might be for some. You got to have math skills, And some of these areas, you have to have insanely good math skills. And others, you just have to know how to do things well. And you have to, very important, that you have to know Excel. And if most people don't, they say they do, but they have no idea what Excel is like in the workplace. It's like you can't even tell that it's Excel sometimes when you open up business worksheets and spreadsheets. Okay, anyway. That is the world that I could suggest that you might want to consider. You can double major. Accounting and finance is huge. Accounting, or rather, finance and insurance. Insurance straight up. I have a couple who majored in marketing and finance. And I thought, that's a weird major, but they're getting darn good salaries coming out. So there you are. Anyway, let me get down to the main topic tonight, which is the Federal Reserve. Special topics, the Federal Reserve. You see, the Federal Reserve, I have to do this as a special topic because most finance books don't really address the Federal Reserve in any meaningful way. Now, they might assume that you learned about it in economics, but there's probably at least some of a darker reason they don't cover it. Because finance imagines itself to be sort of, somewhat, kind of, maybe totally dedicated to free markets, to no government is the best government. The Federal Reserve, a central bank, is a government entity. And it is seen at best as an annoyance or a roadblock or a problem to the efficiency of those beautiful, perfect, pure free markets that libertarians drool over. And the reality is that they don't want to concede how much influence the Federal Reserve has on the economy. And on finance, and on financial markets. And I have to tell you about that, even if the book doesn't. And I'm going to provide you with a little video that's done by the Federal Reserve of St. Louis, District Bank in St. Louis. It covers, in a cheesy cartoon, what I do in this lecture. Dead serious. It's absolutely important that you know how the Federal Reserve works and what it does in order for you to be able to function as a professional in a lot of fields in the coming century. Now, to give you an idea of how important central banks are, by the end of the 1600s, most of Western Europe had the beginnings of central banks in the nations. Almost all. We were a young country, and even after the country started, there was this real dislike of central government. And so the first national bank, not a central bank, but a national bank, was established at the very early years of the country. But then there was this rabble-rousing president in the early 1800s. He was gathering up all the people who saw the government as bad and dangerous. And when he got into office, he allowed the charter of the Second National Bank to die. And so we were in the era of free market. Banks could do whatever they wanted. Anything went. And the best government regulation is no government regulation. Well, this allowed for a lot of problems. One thing was that the banks were concentrated, the heavy banks were concentrated on the east, northeast coast, New York City, Boston, as were the giant shipyards and the shipping companies financed by the banks. This left the South starving for capital. Deep, growing bitterness all through the first half of the 1800s at the way the northern banks were screwing over everyone in the South, the producers, the farmers,
And then they would buy congressmen, and the congressmen would pass tariffs that wrecked the economy even more. The bitterness down there still stands to this day. I can go and visit relatives in Tennessee and Kentucky, and I tell you right now, if you were a Fed, you wouldn't really want to go to some of those places where I call home. I got rid of my accent years ago. Don't worry, I won't start talking like that. The bottom line, though, is that there was massive concentration of financial power in a few northern banks and the families that ran them. And these were not nice people. It was brutal, violent. There was a lot of killing, the whole nine yards. Well, after the Civil War blew out, then the North just absolutely had control. And the scams were just flowing. One I like to tell you about, in the years after the Civil War, there was a general named Ulysses S. Grant who became president. And after he was the president, he wanted something to do with his life while he wrote his memoirs. And so this group of unscrupulous SOBs convinced him to be the face of their investment company. Well, General Grant, President Grant, he could talk any veteran of the Civil War from the Federals to invest their pension in his company's plan. Sure enough, he did it. He got all of these veterans. Maybe, I saw one estimate that 70% of all of the Northern Forces veterans pledged their pensions to General Grant, President Grant. If he says it's good, it's good. And what these scam artists did was they gave President Grant, former President Grant, his own office, all the cigars he wanted. All he had to do was sit there all day and be the face of this con game. He didn't know it was. No, I know that for a fact. He was a good man, a general. He wouldn't have done that to a soldier. He just wouldn't have. Of course, it fell apart, and all of these soldiers lost their pensions. They were penniless, wounded, crippled, PTSD before there was anything like PTSD in a war that was a hell of a lot worse than anything that people see nowadays. And they were going to their old age penniless. There you go. That was a good government is no government regulation at all at work. Story goes that President Grant, horrified by what he'd done and dying of throat cancer, moved to a remote woodland area. And he sat on the porch wrapped in blankets and he wrote his memoirs. Day in, day out, streams of Civil War veterans managed to find where he was. Hundreds and hundreds a day went up to that cabin where they saw him sitting on the porch. You know what they did there? They saluted their general, the man who had screwed them over unintentionally. That gives you an idea, and it got worse in the 1870s. It was just the heyday of unscrupulous characters. Here's something that I found out, and it's a very brutally when I was a consultant. Money brings the worst of the worst scumbags to the dinner table. And when you are talking about banking, that's where the money is. And so you got the most unscrupulous SOBs you could imagine in the banking world. Families that now have reputable names, they're the cream of the crop and all that. Well, that's where they started. They started by screwing people out of their money, murdering, pillaging, and all of that. That's the reality of it. And it was going on and the government didn't do a thing about it. Well, there were laws, of course, but the government hadn't figured out yet. And it happened later. The government figured out that if you're going to make a group of laws to address a business issue, you also have to create an agency that will oversee enforcement of the laws. You can't just say, well, here's a law, obey it. Or here's the law. Oh, you federal marshals, you go out and kick companies that don't obey this law. You have to create an agency, an institution that will take the law, create regulations based on it, and then enforce those on the companies that are subject to it. A good example would be environmental laws. They mean nothing unless there's an environmental protection agency to enforce the laws. Same is true of securities. There's no law that means anything if there's not a Securities Exchange Commission that will oversee enforcement, interpret the complicated laws, and then see to it that they're consistently enforced on the players in the business. Okay, that's the backdrop of it. Now, I'm going to start with an example here. Seems like it's almost kind of random, but it has a purpose. Okay. Now, I want you to imagine some night you, sir, are sleeping in your bed. You got your teddy bear here, you've got your glass of water over here, and you've got your little mobile that's making stars go around on the ceiling, and then the room goes black. And then this glow of light illuminates the entire room. And you hear angels singing, Hosanna. And out of the light comes this long-haired figure. My son, you have done well. You have obeyed me in all ways. So here's $1,000, bro. And he comes back into the light, Hosanna. And he's gone. You got $1,000 out of nowhere. Well, what you do is you're going to run to your bank, madam. The next day, you put in the autonomous infusion, you sir, into her bank of $1,000. We call this the initial or the base. Now, in your bank, you need to make a profit. Well, you've got some money to do it. Now, clearly, you should keep some of it in case he comes back for some of it or he writes a check that you have to honor. So what you're going to do is you're going to set up a required reserve ratio. Let's say that you're going to keep 20% of it in the vault, which would be $200. And then that means, though, that you can lend out $800 at interest and make some money on the interest. That's how a bank makes its money. Okay, so what happens here is that your bank, you, sir, come in and you say, I should like to have a loan. And she says, okay, what for? You say, I want to start a mail escort service. Indeed. Called Cougar's Bait. Okay, and she said, well, this sounds like a good business plan, so she lends you $800, and you give it to you to set up the whole deal. The online, and the complimentary mint and all that kind of stuff. So you pay her the $800, and she takes it back to the bank and deposits it. The bank has now $1,800 on its books. You're saying, no, wait a minute, whoa, time out there. Yeah, that's how it's done. And so that's that part of it. But then, okay, well, we'll have to hold the fractional reserve of $160. That leaves $640 to lend out. Now you go to her bank and you say, I've got a business idea. A real world version of Assassin's Creed. Dark web. Hire us, we'll shoot his hind leg off. Well, that sounds like a good business plan. Yes, indeed. So they set it up. You get your business going. You hire this young woman to write the code, to get the orders in and do the dispatch. One assassin to 813 North High Street. Yeah, just shoot him in the ankle. Thank you. 10-4. Okay, you do all that. So you pay her $640, you go take that money to the bank, and there, spank me is another $640. You see the multiplier effect? There isn't any money there except $1,000, but the bank now, in real records, the economy's money supply is expanding. Now, at the end of this, the total amount will come out to be, now this is a simplistic model, doing it for real, you'd have to add a factor for holding cash balances, but this is pretty good. Okay, the total change in the money supply is going to be the original money times 1 over the required reserve ratio. So in this case, the total new money created by that $1,000 is going to be $1,000 times 1 over 0.20, which is $1,000 times the money multiplier. That's called the money multiplier, that 5. 5 grand out of $1,000. The economy actually grew the money supply, $5,000. You notice something, that as the reserve ratio goes up, the multiplier effect goes down. Like if that was half of the money, that'd be only 1 over 0.5, that'd be only 2. If they dropped it to 0.10, that would be 1 over 0.10, that'd be 10. So it's an inverse relationship there. Nevertheless, there you go. Okay, so here's the deal. Imagine that there is no requirement to keep any money in the vault. So you might keep a few bucks in there, but if suddenly someone walks into that bank and asks for his or her money more than the vault has, the bank immediately goes tap city. It's gone. It's dead. So what can happen here is that an unscrupulous bank could be lending out all of its money, or more likely, just the owners are spending the money. And then when the depositor, one depositor comes in, no money, he goes screaming out, everyone else who deposits money there, all over, game over. It's worse than that, though. Because you could be a very legitimate bank. You keep 20% of your reserves in the vault. But if this unscrupulous, scurrilous, dog-whipping, cat-strangling nose-picker decides that he's going to be unscrupulous, his bank folds. Suddenly, everyone in your bank across the street, everyone says, wait a minute, she's across the street from him. They all come into your bank at the same time. You don't have, even if you're keeping 20%, if they run your bank, you just go like that. And then you down the street, your bank, everyone runs your bank. You had reserves, but they were overwhelmed by the panic. And so a bank panic happens. And not just the one bad bank, but good banks all around it come down. It got even worse. In the 1890s and then in the 1920s, some of those big, powerful, wealthy families and playas, what they would do is they would start a rumor that a bank was in trouble. You could very well be a very legitimate bank, but if I know how to pull the levers of the media and the gossip, I can get people to suddenly freak out and think your bank can't do it. I can say, I went in there and there was no money of mine in there for me to take out. And then all of a sudden, 100 people hear that at once and they go in there and sure enough, self-fulfilling prophecy. And I wreck your bank. And then when you are gone, I buy it up at pennies on the dollar. And I just keep doing that to bank after bank after bank in a neighborhood until I have got market concentration on the whole banking system in that neighborhood, then maybe in that sector of the city, and then in that city. I can just keep doing it over and over and again because I gain credibility every time it looks like it happened after I said it once. I create my own destructive force. Okay, that was going on. Just like in any other era, the 1890s, the 1900s, the 1870s, 80s, They were an era where our government was the best government money could buy. It's just how it happens. Welcome to democracy. And so trying to get meaningful legislation passed that would crack down on this unscrupulous world, it just wasn't going to happen because the politicians were in the pockets of the powerful businessmen, the ones who were the unscrupulous SOBs who had done it all in the first place. It finally got ridiculous. By the time you get to the late 19-aughts, I mean, we were having recessions. This wasn't no longer a microeconomic problem where people were losing their savings, their life's fortunes. It was actually causing recessions, long, deep recessions. People were already living in misery, and it was making that misery even worse. And you have to appreciate that this was the era in which a very powerful force was beginning to rumble in Europe and in the United States. It was called communism. Its cousin, socialism, was by no means weak. It had the ear of organized labor. Although the American Federation of Labor had repudiated the socialist policy platforms of the Knights of Labor, it was still a force to be reckoned with. And there were a lot of people who had lost everything they had who were willing to listen to someone say, "Workers of the world, unite! You have nothing to lose but your chains." That scared. You want to scare the hell out of rich people? Tell them, revolution. Oh, they'll find Jesus right away. And they'll pass legislation. Scare them enough and they'll reform. Here we go. So what happened in the second decade of the 20th century is Congress passed the Federal Reserve Act. Which established a central bank. Now, like I said, welcome to the club, latecomer. The Europeans had had central banks for some of them for centuries. We were the last of the industrialized countries who finally stopped crying about everything's got to be laissez-faire. Leave them alone. Let the free market solve its own problems. That's easy to say until the free market puts a noose around your neck because they've gotten sick of it. So the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 was passed. It established the Federal Reserve System. Which would be seven governors appointed by the president with the advice and the consent of the Senate. One of those seven is the chairman. Don't ever let me trick you. There's seven governors plus a chairman, so there's eight. No, there's seven. One of them is the chairman. Historically, they have been very consummate, intelligent people. That weakened with really the last four chairmen, Greenspan in his later years, and then that foppish Bernanke, and then Uncle Ben the weirdo, and to some extent Janet Yellen, although she's kind of a breath of fresh air. Historically, they were very strong, maybe politically motivated, but they are consummate professionals. Very much in their own ways dedicated to keeping everything going. The seven governors write the regulations. They regulate. In other words, when laws are passed, they write the regulations and promulgate them to the banks. This is how you comply with the regulations. The system divides the country into 12 districts, each one overseen by a district bank.
Now, that means
there's one bank president in each of the 12 districts.
Now, at the level of the Board of Governors, historically, of course, there was a terrible lack of diversity, which is now being overcome. Our current chairman, Janet Yellen, is a shining example of at least finally some diversity coming to the bank. The 12 bank presidents are consummate professionals. They have high degrees in finance, accounting, economics. They are everything. They don't break laws. I've met two of them. I mean, I don't think they even have sex. They're just perfect. Alan, come over here. I was supposed to be introduced, and I am not worthy of your contempt, evil master. They're powerful, heavy duty, and they're really consummate professionals. And at this level, understand that they might be conservative or liberal, but they are not extreme. It's a shade this way or that way. And it's not the screaming leftists and right wingers who are crazily ripping the country apart. These cats, they see you gotta put your personal opinions and your personal prejudices and all that aside, because you're not going to get good answers if you're tainting yourself with your own biases, left or right. They are more moderate. Although they have a strong taste, I can tell you some of the district bank presidents who are quite conservative, but they're not assholes. And they're not, and some are quite pretty liberal, but they're not screaming, spinning-eyed people who don't wash. They're good models for how you conduct yourself as a business person. You can have just your judgment can tell you I am a conservative, or maybe I'm a little on the progressive side, but you don't ever let it influence business. And that's what you see in these people. They're that way. They're moderates, one way or the other. At least most of the time. Greenspan turned really crazy in his last years. But anyhow, okay, now, let me show you something here. Madam, can you tell me that letter right there?
That's an A.
That's an A. What does it say around the letter? I know, right? I can't read it. That's why I'm at YouTube.
It says Bank of Boston.
Bank of Boston.
And then Federal Reserve and Massachusetts.
There you go. This is the district bank that is located in Boston. It oversees the area around Boston, banks in that area. The funniest part is that when the 12 districts were created, almost all of the action was on the East Coast. So the district geography, the districts are very tight and small, all up and down the East Coast. And as you go west, they get bigger and bigger and bigger. So now, what's this one? What's the letter?
L.
And what does it say?
It's Federal Reserve again, and California.
California.
And Bank of San Francisco.
It's a huge region. I mean, back when these were established, no one lived out there. I mean, well, yeah, you had some rattlesnakes and prairie dogs and some very weird people who still thought it was the 1800s shooting up everything. But, I mean, it's like what happened was that when they established them, San Francisco got this giant region, Boston got a tiny region, New York got a tiny region, and now with all this activity out west, LA, I mean, those banks out there, those district banks out there are just going crazy with all of the work they have to do compared to the banks on the East Coast. And it's over a huge geography, too. Now, we are almost right smack between two districts. There's Chicago to the north and St. Louis to the south. We're in the Chicago district here. But I think it's only about 40 miles south of here begins the St. Louis district. Now, every central bank, district bank, rather, has its own flavor. The St. Louis bank is
kind of like the education bank. They work, prepare all of these materials for learning, for schools. They got games on the website. They're the ones who did that video I'm going to put the link to in the scrolling marquee on my website. I mean, and they're, I took my students down there, and they just rolled out, my club students, they just rolled out the red carpet. It was ridiculous. They had the big, heavy duties just talking to them about all the different things this Fed does, and they were literally throwing jobs and internships at my students, and no one wanted it. Well, that's St. Louis. I want to go back to my womb in Chicago. Okay, good, good. They offered them jobs. You work for them, they'll pay for the rest of your education, clear to your PhD. And they got the finest databases in the world. I mean, seriously. I mean, that gives you an idea of what it means to work for the Fed. A lot of people work there for maybe 5 years, and then any bank in the world would hire you at a high salary from there. But that gives you an idea. They were really good to us there. It was wonderful. But then you go to Chicago. I took my students to Chicago once. Well, on one of my trips to Chicago, we thought we were just going to stop in and look in they have an exhibit room at these Feds where you get to see $1 million. You get to see money being shredded. You get to see all these different things. Well, that was an unpleasant experience. They put us all in this one small room in front of the exhibit room. And then they made my students walk in single file. This huge security guard was watching over us. Single file, I was at the back, and the last student went in, and then I was about to go in, and the security guard, she hits me on the knuckles with her nightstick. You stay back. Oh, damn, woman of God. We went out for drinks later. Great girl. But anyway, where the hell was... Oh, okay. Oh. It gives you an idea. The different banks have different characters, and also they kind of self-appoint themselves, well, we're the education one. We're the one who does all of the research for businesses and all this. We're the one who does it. Okay, so they all have kind of a flavor. One thing to know, the New York City Bank, the one in New York City, it's called the Empire Bank. It's a very special bank in the system. It's the only district bank whose president has a permanent voting seat on the FOMC. Now, you see, this, the Fed has all kinds of committees, but this is the biggie, the Federal Open Market Committee. This is the one that decides whether to contract the money supply, driving up interest rates and slowing down the economy, or expand the money supply, causing interest rates to fall, and therefore stimulating the economy. Now, the FOMC has the 7 district members. The 7 governors always have permanent voting seats. Now, from the 12 district bank come 5 more. And they serve rotating terms of 2 years. One district bank president, the Atlanta president, for example, he'd do 2 years, and then he would be off, and another bank president who wasn't on would be. And they do these on staggered basis. However, of the 5, 1 is a permanent voting member. It's only 4 who serve staggered rotating terms. The Empire Bank president has a permanent voting seat. The reason for this is relatively simple. He or she is the one who is the president of the bank that carries out those open market operations to expand and contract the money supply. Again, the Empire Bank is where the decisions of the FOMC are put into operation. The Empire Bank is where the money supply is expanded or contracted based on the decisions of the FOMC. So he has a permanent voting seat. So it's 7 plus 5 are always going to be there. There will be 12 voting members. Yes, go ahead. The 7 and the 5? The 7 is the 7 governors. They are always on the FOMC, permanent voting members. 5 come from the 12 district banks. Each one serves a 2-year term, except for the New York City District Bank president. He always has a vote, permanent. He's always there. He doesn't leave after 2 years. He's always there. This is, now this kind of is ahead of it a little bit, but look, the Federal Reserve Charter said, Fed, you have three duties. Three duties of the Federal Reserve. Now, don't call it the Fed until you're acquainted with it. It's sort of like the students who send me messages, "Hi, Al." Don't you do that. You call it the Federal Reserve until it gives you permission to call it the Fed. Okay, anyway, three duties. The first one is what I told you. The Fed regulates and supervises member banks. Now remember, the governors regulate, they create the regulations, and then the banks, the district banks, enforce, they supervise the banks in their region and say, are you complying with these rules that the governors have set? So the governors regulate, the district bank presidents supervise. Now, interestingly enough, there are other bank regulating organizations. I get every semester, I get these requests. The Comptroller of the Currency actually has regional teams that regulate a certain kind of bank, and they are always looking for people. I've gotten, I think, 3 of my former students are now working for them. They love the work, 4 days a week, government benefits, home every weekend, meals on the road paid for. Okay, that's the first duty. The second duty is interesting. And there's a story that I want to tell you behind this. The Federal Reserve serves as a bank for banks. Banks have to put their money somewhere. They have to have checking accounts and all that, just like anyone else. And the Federal Reserve provides this service. But it operates in direct competition with private commercial banks that do the same thing. The rules are simple. The Federal Reserve, in its role as a bank for banks, cannot price undercut the private commercial banks. Much more importantly, the Federal Reserve is absolutely, it's charged with advancing the technology of banking. And every time it comes up with a new technological innovation, it has to give that technology to all of its commercial bank competitors. Everything you know about banking in the modern age, I mean, do you remember the checks with those magnetic ink things, those weird numbers on them? That was a Fed invention and created the entire magnetic ink recognition MIR system. It has led the, it did the technology so you can swipe your card and 10 seconds later you've got your food and all that kind of stuff. That's all the Fed, and it has to just develop it and then just share it with its commercial competitors. Even at that, the Fed gives through its bank for bank operations, It gives the Treasury every year a check for billions of dollars in what it makes. And the commercial banks that do this, they do just as well for profit for private enterprise. A few years back, I called I had another matter, but I had asked a fellow PhD student from many years ago. He was working at the district bank in St. Louis. And I said, just out of curiosity, how many banks use the Fed's banking services versus how many banks use private commercial banks' banking services? And he said he couldn't tell me for the whole nation, but he could tell me for the St. Louis district. He said it's about 65% of the banks use the Fed, 35% use commercial banks for their operations. And they all do just fine. Now, here's the interesting part of it. Back in 2009, there was this big war blew out about health insurance. You know, you had the one side screaming, universal health insurance for everyone, government paid. You had the other side screaming, free enterprise, private enterprise, that's the only way to do it. And I was writing my political commentaries, and I said, folks, there's the model right there. It's been working for a century. Just have the government offer health insurance and direct competition with the private enterprise, but require that there be no price predation and that all technologies be shared. It has worked at the scale of hundreds of billions of dollars in the entire banking system of the country. Well, no one wanted to hear my stupid opinion of what we should do. And so the war rages on, free enterprise, pure free markets versus universal government-sponsored health insurance. But there's a model right there. You can actually have the two coexist. It works. We know it does, and it's been working for a century almost. Anyway, enough of that one. Try this one. Three duties. Here's the third duty. The Federal Reserve conducts monetary policy. In other words, the Fed decides whether to expand the money supply to cause the economy to grow faster or contract the money supply to cause the economy to slow down or leave the money supply alone and let it, because it's looking good the way it is. Now, this is the one hardly anyone has any idea this is going on, especially one aspect of it. But now, there are three different ways the Fed can conduct monetary policy. The least likely that it's going to use, A, is that required reserve ratio. The Fed can change it. But the problem is, that's like a meat axe. It's like you move that a little bit and the money supply just like that or like that. So more likely the Fed would be using the required reserve ratio as a metric of people's confidence in the banks. Here's what I mean by that. When the attack, this makes me feel very sad to even ask this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Madam, how many students in this room do you suppose remember the attacks of September 11th, 2001? Yes, a diddly squat, yeah. That'll be the number, yeah. Do you remember the day the attacks happened? There might be a vague memory. It was so dramatic. I mean, being a veteran, I thought, you know, it sounded awfully harsh at the time. Really, is that all you idiots have? We're going to kick your asses now. Okay, but, you know, it was horrible, and there was a sense that people were going to freak about this, and they were going to run the banks. You know, that's what you would do if there were a massive national crisis. So what the Fed did was they rocketed the required reserve ratio upward just to make sure the banks had enough money if the run did happen. What was interesting was it didn't happen. There was no run. So, you know, and then there's two more
The Fed can change the amount, the discount rate, which is what it charges for money that it lends to banks. And then it can literally use these things called open market operations to actually contract and expand the money supply.